Another endearingly shambolic podcast from WeDigPodcasts.com.
Hi, we dig music, and because of this we've kept the music in our podcast at a low background level because we believe that you should support the artists by buying their records and going to their gigs. If you want to hear the songs in full, we've made Spotify playlists of all available music featured in each episode, which you can find on WeDigPodcasts.com. You can also join in the discussion on Facebook and Twitter by searching at WeDigMusicPcast. Finally, if you dig what you're hearing, please subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice, write a review if possible, and tell all your friends that you think would enjoy it. Anyway, enough of my yakking. On with the podcast. Hello and welcome to We Dig Music. I'm Colin, and with me, as usual, are my comrades and co-hosts, Ian.
Hello.
And Tracy.
Hello.
As usual, each episode we take a letter of the alphabet and talk about two bands, a well-known band and a less well-known band, or a headliner and a support, if you want to do it that way. It's the F episode.
Fuck knuckles.
So that's F for Foxtrot, not S for Sierra, even though they sound identical.
No, they don't.
If you've got no ears. They do on the phone. We're going to talk about Father John Misty and Faith No More. So, Tracy, tell us about Father John Misty.
Okay.
Taylor Swift every night inside the Oculus Rift after Mr. and the Mrs. finished dinner and the dishes.
And now the features definition. Father John Misty, or Joshua Michael Tillman, is an American singer-songwriter, guitarist, and drummer.
And hipster.
Definitely.
Originally recorded.
He also has no eyebrows.
What?
Seriously.
Has he not? I've not noticed that.
Oh, well, they're very faint, considering okay. He's got incredibly dark hair.
I was going to say, he's probably used all of the eyebrow hair on his beard.
Yeah.
They're pretty shit eyebrows, aren't they?
They are.
Shit eyebrows is the best insult ever. Brilliant, carry on.
Originally recording under the name J. Tillman, he's released a steady output of solo recordings since 2004. He's been a member of a number of other bands, most notably Fleet Foxes, more F alliteration.
There we go. I wondered why his stuff sounded like Fleet Foxes. That explains it.
See, I don't think
he was the drummer.
But,
so
yeah, but the vocal harmonies are kind of reminiscent.
Yeah.
See, I didn't listen to him for years because I hate Fleet Foxes. But anyway, carry on.
You hate Fleet Foxes?
Yeah, especially if you like the first Bon Iver album, which sounds kind of like a less produced Fleet Foxes.
Yeah.
Fleet Foxes are way more Mumford, as far as I'm concerned.
Ouch! Take that back!
No. They are part of the same disease.
I mean, you're right about him sounding a little like Bon Iver. I mean, J. Tillman, his early J. Tillman albums, because he's released 8 albums as J. Tillman and 4 as Father John Misty. And his early albums actually sound like Bon Iver without the vocal effects. It's kind of...
I must listen to them, because the bits of early stuff that I've heard, I wasn't that keen on.
Really?
But I'll listen further.
In fact, some of it actually sounds like it was recorded in a log cabin, unlike Justin Vernon's stuff.
Yeah.
It's kind of a Forever done right.
What do you mean, done right?
In a log cabin.
Forever, forever ago is a fucking masterpiece.
And also was recorded in a log... It was just a fancy log cabin.
A very fancy log cabin. And Father John Misty's wife's name is Emma, so that works.
Unless... They hadn't split up, so...
Yeah.
No.
Well, as far as...
So he wouldn't have... He's kind of written his own For Emma album, though. I mean, because I Love You, Honey Bear is largely written about his wife.
Yeah. But it's not a breakup album.
Oh, God, no. No, it's an I'm Absolutely In Love With My Wife album.
Yeah.
Which, explain the cover art then. Because that's just really fucking weird. Like, it looks like he's trying to be weird.
Yeah.
And psychedelic.
Because, I mean...
Well, and the music is not.
I don't know who did the cover art, because the cover of Pure Comedy is quite similar as well. Very busy, a lot of...
I prefer that one.
Do you?
I prefer the artwork on that one, yeah. His latest album's the best album cover he's done.
When I was doing my research, I sat here with this my friend Indrik, and we were looking at the album cover,
so
and he's like...
When was that, Ian?
That was earlier today.
Earlier today.
When have I ever lied about my lack of research, right? Like, I did it probably about 2.5 hours ago.
And we started recording 2 hours and 20 minutes ago.
Yeah, we were talking about it. And his comment on the one artwork, you know, it's like a black and white, very detailed drawing, and he's like... So, you know, like the in psychiatric hospitals, they do art therapy, and these psychiatric patients do these very, very detailed, massive drawings on huge canvases. I was like, oh, fuck, yeah, that's exactly what the artwork on that album looks like.
Could be deliberate, that.
It could have just been done by a psychiatric... It's not exactly our problem by Iron Monkey, though, is it?
No.
Done by a proper crazy person.
I've not listened to much of his Jay Tillman stuff.
It's kind of really folky. I mean, because so he's only credited as being the drummer of Fleet Foxes for their 2011 Helplessness Blues album.
Okay.
But he was playing live with them before that. He in fact was their support artist on Fleet Foxes tour. So he'd come out, do a solo set, and then do a set as drummer of Fleet Foxes.
I've definitely seen footage of him playing drums with them at Glastonbury.
Yeah. So he did the tour with them for the Fleet Foxes album in 2008. My friend Keith on Twitter, he saw them on that tour, and he loved the Jay Tillman stuff, but he can't bear Father John Misty.
Okay.
He treats them as two different artists.
Can I just highlight the fact that it was a mere 5 minutes before we hit the first My Friend on Twitter reference?
But, you know, he loved the early Jay Tillman stuff. I mean, he loved the first Bon Iver album, and then couldn't bear them afterwards, so it's...
Strange man, Keith, you're a strange man.
And see, I'm weirdly coming down on the side of one of Tracy's Twitter followers at this point, which is a fucking strange scenario.
But, I mean, he thinks that the early Bon Iver albums... the early Jay Tillman albums are a criminally overlooked in comparison. But then the thing is, the Bon Iver albums...
Well, they are. I didn't know they existed until we started doing the podcast.
And there's a reason you won't have known they existed, because some of them aren't on Spotify, and some of them were barely even released. They were put out just up on the website, but they had no promotion at all.
Are we talking a bit like King Creosote, where he's got loads of CDRs and stuff?
Yeah, one of them...
Finds a box every now and again and sends it to...
Tracy's house, don't
Tracy's house directly.
I mean, Minor Works was just done as a limited CDR. That was in 2006. But I mean, there's some beautiful songs on that. With Wolves, it's just an acoustic strummed number, just gorgeous. But then there's other stuff on there, you know, beautiful arrangements with cello, violin, pedal steel, in fact.
I do like pedal steel.
Mm.
But then, you know, one of his other ones, 2006, Long May You Run, Jay Tillman, it sounds like it was recorded on a tape recorder in a spare room. It's beautiful, but it just sounds like demos.
Yeah.
I mean, his last... You start,
which is a vast difference from his very, very well-produced
Father
John Misty.
But then his last solo album, as it were, Singing Axe, in 2010, was recorded by Steve Albini.
Okay.
As we established in the Steve Albini special, anyone can be recorded by Steve Albini.
Oh yeah, sure. He was just there for 3 days recording it. But I think
that might be his first mention this series as well.
God damn.
I thought we got it out of our system.
No, sorry, never.
He'll be back.
I don't know. I don't know anything about the recording of this, and whether it was just the way that that Tillman was going, or whether there's any Albini influence. But there's a real sense of brooding that's growing on that album, rather than just the delicate folk of his other stuff. This has got much more darkness. It's got some like really disquieting guitars.
Well, that'd fit in with like the Nina Nastasia records and stuff like that. Mm. Albini's recorded before.
Bringing out darker elements of an artist.
He actually wrote darker songs and was like, I think Albini's the man for this.
Yeah. Well, maybe that would make
sense, I think.
Mm. I mean, but the last song on that album, A Seat at the Table, is his turning point. And that's talking about he kind of gave up on the Jay Tillman persona. Because weirdly, even though you might think my father John Misty is the character and Jay Tillman was him, he puts it the other way around. He says if anything, Jay Tillman was the character that he was acting.
But when did he say that?
Oh, retrospectively.
Yeah, but when? Are we talking since the most recent album?
Yeah, he said it in a recent interview.
Okay. Because there seems to be, on the most recent album, there's a few clues that he might be trying to finish with the Father John Misty persona.
Basically,
Father John, yeah, the last track on, there were a lot of references to suicide and that kind of thing. There's Please Don't Die, which is a great track, but it's sort of, the chorus is, it switches perspective, so the verses are him talking, and then the chorus is his wife. It's her telling him not to die.
Yeah, I mean, it's a gorgeous, like, country style ballad.
It's a really, really nice song.
With a story.
And then there's the last track, We're Only People, and there's not much anybody can do about that. Seems to be hinting of an end to things, and I don't think that he's talking about an end to his life. I think he's talking about an end to the character, and potentially not moving on to something else.
So is there a proper characterised persona for Father John Misty?
I believe that my interpretation of it is that Father John Misty is the more debauched rock star version of Jay Tillman. So he's the one that for a while lived in a hotel, which the most recent album was written while he was living in a hotel. So I think he sort of separated from his wife a little bit.
He actually explained in an interview only last year, it was done on Radcliffe and McConey show in May last year, actually on the day of a gig I went to in Manchester, and he said Father John Misty isn't a character, it's just a sequence of phonetic sounds that look good on a t-shirt. I don't know how sounds can look good on a t-shirt, but we'll leave that one. He said, it's not a character. He said, why would I callous my smooth bourgeois hands for the sake of some character? It's more a sensibility to call myself something ridiculous. And I get jollies from seeing this ridiculous name on a marquee. And that's a better indicator of who I am than putting my own name up there.
He sounds like a fucking bellend.
At the same time...
His delicate bourgeois...
Oh, yeah.
No, every interview he is taking the piss.
Oh, right, okay.
Well, he's taking the piss, but he is also...
Massively, massively tongue-in-cheek. He is pretentious, but he's really... I saw hilariously an interview that he was doing on BBC Breakfast.
Oh, God, yeah, I've got some quotes written down from that.
They asked him why... what's your reason for calling yourself Father John Misty?
Yeah.
And his response was... Does someone who calls himself Father John Misty have a good reason for doing anything?
That
interview was hilarious.
Yeah, because they didn't know what to make of him at all.
It reminded...
He knew that these people weren't his target audience.
It reminded me of the kind of interviews you used to see with your favourite band on kids' TV, they were just asking idiotic questions.
I saw a similar feature, which I don't think I mentioned in the episode, but when we were researching for the Cure episode, there was a ongoing feature for a week where this was from 1992, where it was on TVAM. With The Cure going on the QE2 to America.
What the hell?
It was the most bizarre thing ever. Because Breakfast TV is its lowest common denominator.
It was until the One Show happened.
But that's not Breakfast TV.
That's the thing.
Oh, you mean that's, yeah.
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 That was my point.
So now it's second lowest common denominator.
Well, Steph, one of the hosts on the BBC Breakfast, they've been talking to him about his politics that was on that album. Yeah. And they're saying, like, you like writing about stuff, don't you? And he said, oh, yeah, I love stuff. And then she goes, oh, well, how do you decide what to write about? And he sort of rolls his eyes and says, well, I've got this wheel, this big wheel in my house that's got topics on it. And then there's another wheel that's got the key that I'll sing it in, and I spin these wheels. Which massively taking the piss.
That question, there's one that Richard Herring on his podcast, he's got emergency questions that he asks that are quite often things like, would you rather have a handmade of ham or an armpit that dispenses sun cream is one of his questions. But one of them that he asks people every time is, where do you get your crazy ideas? Because it's just such a cliched question that people that have no idea, and that's pretty much the same sort of...
I guess this feeds into why the only stuff I've heard about Father John Misty has been people going, no, but it's a joke, right?
I think it is. The thing is, though, on that other interview I mentioned, the Radcliffe and McConey one, they started goading him. And I think he was getting a bit pissed off, but then he was pissing them off too. And they're all talking over each other. And Tillman says to McConey, I'm making you quite flustered. And he said, no, you're not making me flustered in the slightest. You're making me exasperated, but they're two different things. But then Tillman comes back with, there's nothing more flustering you can say to someone than, I'm making you flustered. So McConey went, well, I bow to your superior knowledge. And it was like, oh, shit, awkward.
Yeah.
Radcliffe said at the very end of the interview, well, that was interesting. I felt like Eamon Holmes with David Blaine.
Yeah, brilliant. I was, because of the Fleet Foxes thing, I completely dismissed Father John Misty entirely.
Yeah, like, I didn't, that wasn't my reason for dismissing him. I the name is shit. And I know I should have learnt by now with the whole Biffy Clyro Block Party thing, that I should just go, that's a shit name. What happened last time you didn't like a band with a shit name in? Yeah. You enjoyed them when you finally listened to them, but that's not what happened here. It's just another American Music Club scenario.
I think he's quite similar to John Grant, who you did like.
Yeah, but he's not as good as John Grant.
There are some songs on the latest album actually that I think could be John Grant songs.
There's
almost
things on all of his albums that could be John Grant songs. I'd completely dismissed him in the early days. Kept hearing bits about him and heard little bits that were sort of all right, but nothing really grabbed me.
Yeah.
I dismissed him as a shit John Grant for ages.
And it's like editors being a shit Interpol.
Yeah, exactly.
No,
exactly.
John
Grant's got better eyebrows.
So I...
he's got eyebrows.
He's got eyebrows. And he's a fancy hodor.
Exactly, whereas this guy looks like standard hipster.
So, I got a ticket for All Point East Festival, which Bjork was playing, and Bajek, and Father Bajon Bajamisti, and Sylvan Esso. And I...
Sylvan Gesso.
Yeah. So, some of my friends, Lisa and Sarah... Well, Lisa.
Some of your friends, Lisa
in particular.
Look, 50% of Lisa and 25% of Sarah.
Yeah. No, Lisa in particular is a massive Father John Misty fan. He was the main person.
Yeah, I saw her yesterday. She was excited I'm doing this today.
So, I thought, okay, well, there's nobody else that he's on with that clashes when he's on. I'll check a bit out. And then he released the video for Mr. Tillman.
Right.
Which was the first single, I think, off his new album, God's Favourite Customer.
Yeah.
And I couldn't get it out of my head for weeks. I don't think I was that keen on it at first, but it grew on me. And then I listened to a couple of other tracks. Then I saw him live, and it was really good. It helped that All Point East Festival is the best sound system I've ever heard at a festival. Clearest PA. And it was at Victoria Park, where... in London, where I've been to other festivals in the past where the sound is and the whole thing's been terrible. All Points East Festival was amazing.
Wasn't that the one with all the like the really shit bar and everything like that that went?
No, that was the that was Finsbury Park with Queens of the Stone Age. That was the week afterwards.
Right,
I didn't go to that one. That they had an issue where the bar staff at festivals are usually volunteers.
Yeah, yeah.
And they had 200 volunteers not turn up. So that I think they've got something like 30 people to run all of the bars at this festival site.
Which is just horrifying.
Which meant that there were just 4-hour long queues for the bars and stuff like that.
They'd also only arranged there to be one exit point.
That's fairly often at festivals, it depends on the park.
Mm.
You know, there was only one exit point at All Points East, it was still an absolutely perfectly run festival. If the exit point's big enough, it's absolutely fine.
Yeah.
And if it's managed properly.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so really enjoyed his set. I missed the end of it because we had to go over to get a good spot for Beck, although we could have stayed and watched the end.
Yeah.
But then I possibly wouldn't have had the best macaroni and cheese I've ever had in my life.
Okay, then.
But, yeah.
So what we've really gathered from this is that Father John Misty is not as important as macaroni and cheese.
No, not as important as Beck.
And macaroni
Beck
and
was,
cheese.
Beck was still the best person I saw that day at the festival.
Okay.
But... he was really good, and then I've listened to more and more of it, revising for the podcast, and God's Favourite Customer is possibly my favourite album of this year.
Wow.
So far. I mean, obviously we're only halfway through the year.
Yeah.
But I've ordered it on limited edition Indies Only vinyl.
I've got that one as well. You pay extra for the foil tears on the cover.
Not just that, it's the purple swirly vinyl, which
yeah.
is beautiful.
It is. I've got that one.
Yeah, so that's on its way from Banquet Records at the moment.
Just so you know, that sound that you didn't possibly perceive was me just judging both of them really heavily for paying extra money for fucking tears
it was
on
like
the
a
cover
quid
of a
extra.
Here we go with another quote from someone I speak to on Twitter. Will really doesn't like him. He calls him Father Elton John Misty.
No, it wasn't. I've got it written down.
What?
Father Elton John Pisstake is what Willie McAlpine
See, that's,
said.
That's a much better name.
And it was in response to Roscoe saying Father John Miserable.
Some of his stuff is kind of 70s stomping ballads.
Have you heard what Ryan Adams calls him?
No.
Elton Josh.
Do you know, back in 2006, he was opening for Josh Ruse.
Is that Roos? I thought it was Rouse.
Whatever.
Who? But who?
I know who he is. His album
mid-2000s folk singer.
Oh, right. I should have assumed.
He had an album called 1972 that's really good.
And around that time, of course, there was also Josh Ritter putting stuff out. So we've got a hat trick of Josh's.
Well, he also did a tour with where he was the drummer in Harmar Superstars band. Harmar Superstars' real name is Sean Tillman. They're not related, but they called the tour the Two Tillmans Tour. And Harmar is in he's in the video for Total Entertainment Forever, which was off the Pure Comedy album.
Right.
Which is a brilliant... The opening lyric of that song is, "Bedding Taylor Swift every night inside the Oculus Rift." Which is an excellent lyric.
That is a good lyric.
I don't like Pure Comedy as much, though.
The album is far too long. There are songs on it that are fantastic.
Yeah.
Pure Comedy itself is really good.
It is.
Leaving LA, I like. It's 13
but
minutes
long. But it's too long.
But it works as a song, but it overall the album is too long.
Yeah.
Because it's like 78 minutes long. I mean, some albums can get away with that. Disintegration, obviously. Yeah, it does tend to drag a bit. And I've not really got into the other two, the first two albums yet.
I Love You, Honey Bear is my favourite. It's where I started listening to him.
The title track's great, and Shadow Lobby number 4 and Bored in the USA are all good.
Yeah, Bored in the USA, I love that. That just disenchanted political rant.
Yeah. But then, the best political rant, obviously, is Pure Comedy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that whole album is a rant. I mean, God, if you wanted to hear some more pretentious stuff from him...
Yeah, why not? Fire away.
So, because, Pure Comedy is kind of like... It's got themes of progress, technology, fame, social media. It's about humanity, largely, though. And he wrote an 1,800-word-long essay about its symbolism and meaning...
Yeah, that's pretty pretentious.
And anyway, so I'll read a bit of it. Pure comedy is the story of a species born with a half-formed brain. The species' only hope for survival, finding itself on a cruel, unpredictable rock surrounded by other species who seem far more adept at this whole thing, and to whom they are delicious? Is the reliance on the other, slightly older, half-formed brains. This reliance takes on a few different names as their story unfolds, like love, culture, family, etc. Over time, and as their brains prove to be remarkably good at inventing meaning where there is none, the species becomes the purveyor of increasingly bizarre and sophisticated ironies. These ironies are designed to help cope with the species' loathsome vulnerability and to try and reconcile how disproportionate their imaginative is to the monotony of their existence.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And,
Like, it's good that he thought it through, I guess.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Like,
I think he'd already formulated a lot of the ideas, but, well, obviously he had because he'd started recording the album. But Pure Comedy, just while that was being recorded, he played at a festival.
Yeah.
And had what I think was staged, but. Basically a breakdown on stage where he walked on stage and just had this massive rant, a lot of which ended up as lyrics
in
Pure Comedy and
Leaving LA.
He then played Leaving LA, which is a 13 minute long song,
and then stormed off.
So he'd been on stage for probably 20 minutes because he had this 7 minute long rant, played a 13 minute long song, and then went off stage,
right?
And got a hell of a lot of publicity out of it. So I think it was, because that was one of the first major things I'd really picked up on him. I knew that the I Love You Honey Bear album had been released, and but that was one of the first major news stories, because that was around the sort of time of his big he had a massive Twitter beef. I don't think I've ever said Twitter beef before. Twitter argument with Ryan Adams.
Because he doesn't have a Twitter account now. I think
he got rid of it after fighting with Ryan Adams.
Yeah, yeah.
But, so when Ryan Adams released his cover... So he did a complete cover album of Taylor Swift's 1989.
Yeah, which I still haven't listened to.
It's quite good.
It's good.
But it's all done in sort of Ryan Adams' acoustic folk sort of style. So Father John Misty, without even listening to it... released on his SoundCloud two tracks of what he claimed was an album inspired by it, which were Taylor Swift lyrics as if he'd never heard the tune, sung in the style of Lou Reed over a Velvet Underground backing type thing.
Fucking hell.
They're interesting. I listened to them on YouTube the other night just as a fuck off Ryan Adams kind of thing. Which obviously Ryan Adams wasn't too pleased about, and then started calling him Elton Josh. And
it's weird how much publicity people are getting from these ridiculous.
Ryan Adams is notorious for arguing with people.
Yeah, but the whole time you might be thinking that Tillman is a bit of a pretentious wanker.
He is, even though I like him.
Underneath, he seems like a cool guy. He does these like secret acts of kindness to his fans. Someone else I know on Twitter, he lives in Indiana.
Massive. Is it Erie?
No. Bearded Stephen.
Ah, yeah.
As opposed to other Stephen.
I knew he lived in America, I just didn't know he was in Indiana.
Yeah, He'd seen him a few times, and he was really trying... He put some photos up of a show he'd been to see, and he was trying to get hold of tickets to some tiny special show that was being recorded, and he couldn't get the tickets. Father John Misty saw these tweets and got in touch with him and put him on his guest list and said, yeah, come along, and he thanked him afterwards.
Oh, wow. That's pretty cool.
And then there's another, and someone else who couldn't get, he lost his tickets to a show, and Tillman contacted him by DM and put him on the guest list for a show. And,
oh, that's cool.
You know, random acts of kindness. So
he's, I think he's got a good sense of humour.
Yeah.
And the reason I'm not bothered by the pretentiousness is I think it is mostly an act.
Yeah, it's not exactly Jack White, is it?
He describes himself, he said in that BBC Breakfast interview that he described his music to cab drivers, he's a sarcastic Michael Bublé.
Yes, I've got that written down in here.
It's actually a fantastic description, yeah, I like
it. It works.
Yeah. The thing is, though, I mean, he has got a good voice.
Oh, yeah.
He's got an amazing voice.
It's not just his voice and his lyrics. He's as an instrumentalist and an arranger.
Yeah.
He's fantastic. Because, I mean, obviously with him being a drummer, he plays drums on most of his albums. Some of the drumming on, particularly on the new album, I know I'm concentrating mainly on the new album, but that's because I've been listening to it constantly for the last couple of weeks. There's some... Hangout at the Gallows, which is the opening track on there, there's some drum fills on there that are absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
And they remind me, and some people that don't know much about music will think that this isn't a compliment, they're really Ringo Starr-esque. Ringo is a fucking better drummer than he gets credit for. He came up with some really interesting fills. And that's the kind of rhythms that he's coming up with on that. I think possibly what really grabbed me on that particular track as well, there's a falsetto vocal bit where he sings "What's Your Politics, What's Your Religion," that really reminds me of like a male Tori Amos. I'm a big Tori Amos fan. It's the way he sings it and the instrumentation behind it totally reminds me of Tori Amos.
I mean, he's such a performer as well. And he really, I mean, live he does play up to it. He has lots of moments where he'll pose knowing people are taking pictures, and he drops to his knees a lot. and I mean, I did enjoy him live, but I don't. Well, if I go and see him again, I certainly wouldn't go down the front because I couldn't bear all the squealing girls and the squealing boys for that matter. So much squealing.
We were fairly far back, but I definitely didn't notice that at All Points East.
Yeah. Might be different at a festival, though.
Yeah.
I mean.
But, cool.
No, I kind of want to check him out now to a greater extent, but I'm still not
I think
sure.
What helped with the new album compared to his previous ones is it's a shorter album.
Yeah.
So I think it's a bit more direct and less bloated.
Yeah.
So it's like he's refined it down to just what it needs to have there. I don't think there's any real filler tracks on there. Disappointing Diamonds Are the Rarest Kind was released as one of the advanced tracks, and I really wasn't that keen on it.
Yeah.
But in the context of the album, it fits a lot better. But I still think that Mr. Tillman is fantastic, and just the whole thing, it's just really, really good.
It's got really lovely instrumentation through it as well, and really nice piano line. It's got a Glock in there.
The production, a Glockenspiel, that is not like shooting pistols at
me. I misheard it completely. I heard Glock. It's like a small fashion deal. Okay.
Do you know that I still haven't quite got over my Record Store Day disappointment from a few years ago?
Was that the I Love You Honey Bear? Was it a heart-shaped?
Yeah, it was red heart-shaped vinyl. It was just a version of I Love You Honey Bear, but it was called I Loved You Honey Bee. And I really, really wanted a copy, and they owned...
Was it just a misprinted label?
And each store only had, like, maybe a couple of copies, and I queued at three different stores throughout the day, and I'd missed them each time.
See, if I'd have known at the time that you needed it, I could have picked that up.
Oh, were you Ahead Records?
Ahead Records, yeah.
And then by the time I got home, it's on eBay for £50 already.
Yeah.
Which really pissed me off.
Yeah, that tends to happen... meant to mention this in the Bob Dylan episode, but that's one of the reasons I've sort of was a bit disillusioned with Record Store Day this year. One of their big releases this year was Dylan and the Dead,
right?
Which is a live album with Bob Dylan and the Grateful Dead.
Yeah.
And it's one of the worst albums ever recorded. They're out of tune, out of time, and just absolutely terrible. So, Record Store Day, get your act together. Have some good releases next year, and I might do it again.
Yeah.
Like, you know, all the Cure albums from Wish Onwards, please. Thank you.
Head Records is reopened now, though, so...
Yep. So I may well be there next year again, anyway.
You probably will.
I probably will. I didn't do it this year.
You're like one of these Glastonbury people that just complains about the lineup, then goes and has a good time, and then buys a ticket for the next one.
Never complain about Glastonbury.
No, I didn't say you were one.
But it's the only year I've complained about Record Store Day was this year.
Oh,
okay. Didn't bother doing it. Previous years, there's been stuff that I've wanted, and I've managed to get. So, but I think we should probably talk about Faith No More.
We should.
So, Ian, tell us about Faith No More.
Okay. Headlining F band, Faith No More.
Yeah.
Sometimes abbreviated as FNM. Unsurprisingly, because they're not going to abbreviate it to like FANMIE or something, are they? It's fucking ridiculous.
No, because some of those weren't even letters.
But saying FN.
Yeah, they were.
Saying FNM is actually harder than saying
Faith
No More.
Yes, it is.
Phonetically.
Yeah.
Do you know when they were formed?
Early 80s.
No. 1979.
Okay.
Really?
Yeah.
They are almost as old as me.
They're older than me.
Before settling on their current name in 1982. They used to perform under the name Sharp Young Men, and later Faith No Man, which is weirdly the name of a Faith No More tribute band.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Bassist Billy Gould and drummer Mike Borden are the longest remaining members of the band.
Mike Puffy Borden.
Yes, Mike Puffy Borden. Not so much anymore. That's apparently been dropped.
No.
Another thing conspicuous by its absence from this Wikipedia article is the fact that Jim Martin used to play guitar with them. There's no mention
of him
at all.
That's because he didn't join until relatively late on. For the first few years, they had low... It was Bill Gould and Roddy Bottom.
Yeah, no, that's not my point.
Yeah.
John Hudson is listed as the guitarist.
Right.
It was the guy who joined after they fired Jim Martin, isn't it?
If you look at how long he's been in the band...
Yeah, but, this is like their Scientology Jim Martin. They've just erased him from
it. He must be on the wiki. You'll find him in a minute.
I probably will, but, like...
Big, sick, ugly Jim Martin.
You know, I haven't found him yet.
Is he not even in the past members section?
He was definitely there. I've seen him in videos.
Past members. List of Faith No More band members is the past members.
I was going to say, they've
probably a lot.
They've had a hell of a lot. One of their early singers, although not for very long and she never recorded anything, was Courtney Love.
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
Tracy's researched this.
Also, moving on, though, because we haven't named everyone, obviously... Most famous lyricist vocalist was Mike Patton, and the most appropriately named gay man in the world, keyboardist Roddy Bottom.
He's I think probably the most distinctive element of the band is
definitely
how prominent Roddy's keyboards are.
Yeah, because there's loads of bands with keyboard players in, but
they're not that high in the mix.
No. Like he's definitely a signature part of the sound.
It's the three of them, isn't it, who it's the core members.
Yeah.
Are Roddy, Bill and Mike Borden.
Yeah, yeah, because the bass is super prominent.
Drums, bass and keyboards.
Yeah.
And then everyone else has swapped in and out of the band over the years.
Yeah, I mean, Mike Patton is definitely the most well-known.
He's the classic vocalist, but then, they had so
unless
many
to speak
vocals
to someone of my age who preferred the Chucky era.
Yeah.
But he did one album.
No, he didn't. He did two.
Did he two albums? Introduce Yourself and
We Care A Lot.
We Care A Lot was before.
I didn't even know that was an album.
Yeah,
it was just a song. My God. And I'm the one that's doing the introduction.
That song is actually on both albums.
It is, yeah. Strangely.
They re-recorded it. The one on We Care A Lot, I think,
is
better.
He's dead now as well.
He died last year.
Yeah, like just after he played the flapper.
Really?
Yeah, he played the flapper.
I didn't know that.
Like, and it happened really, really soon after that.
That's really sad.
Yeah.
Oh, I wish I'd have known that. I'd have gone and seen it. I've completely blanked
that's,
on his
fucking
surname.
That's like the weird Chuck Mosley.
Mosley, that's it. I should know that. Par Birmingham.
See, I didn't know the first album, actually, but I've got Introduce Yourself on vinyl. I bought it the year it came out, and I love that album. It's remained a classic to this day.
Yeah. See, for me, the Faith No More album is Angel Dust.
I was always Real Thing.
Real Thing's great, but...
I love Real Thing too.
So they started out as kind of rap funk metal.
Yeah, you can see why Anthony Kiedis threw his toys out of the pram and said Mike Patton had stolen his stage moves and his image and stuff.
But then they were doing that with Chuck at the same sort of time. I'm not even sure who started first, because, well, I mean, Faith No More started before that, but I don't know if they had that sound. Cause what year was We Care A Lot?
It would have been 87.
87. So
the album or the song?
The album.
85.
Yeah, because Patton joined in 88.
Yeah. 88, yeah.
85 was the first album, and then Introduce Yourself came out in 87.
Yeah. So the first Red Hot Chili Peppers album is round about mid-80s, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So there is a legitimate, you know, who copied who kind of thing there.
It does speak volumes about how, ill-informed Anthony Kiedis is about how relevant a vocalist he is there.
Yeah.
Mike Patton, a man with a massive, massive... Like, his vocal range is bigger than Axl Rose's.
His vocal range?
Huge.
Okay,
huge.
Let's get this article. He has the biggest, widest vocal range known to man, as far as we know. Mike Patton's vocal range is from E-flat 1 to E7, which is 6 octaves and half a note.
Which is insane.
Yeah.
Axel's like six, is it?
Fifth. So you've got Mike Patton, Corey Taylor from Slipknot is the second.
Wow, really?
Diomander Gallus is the third.
Yeah.
And fucking weird. Dave Lee Roth is fourth.
Where's Morton Harkett on this list?
I don't know.
Because apparently he has sung the highest recorded note.
Yes, but that means that he may have sung the highest, but he'd have to sing a really low one to be on this list as well.
But he has some quite low notes as well.
Yeah, he sings in a low register.
He's got a big range. Maybe this is rock vocalists. They are all rock vocalists.
Diomander Gallus isn't.
No.
She's sort of avant-garde.
Yeah, but she always gets mentioned in Kerrang and Metal Hammer and stuff.
No, this has got Mariah Carey in the list.
Oh, my God.
So.
All right, then.
Mariah Carey always... I used to hear people saying she'd got the widest vocal range.
No.
She's actually 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, joint ninth with exactly the same vocal range, not the same notes, as Roger Waters, which I really wouldn't have expected.
No.
I was amazed by that. Roger Waters has a 4 octaves, 6.5 note.
Yeah, because I saw him last week.
And yet still he's dull.
Paul McCartney is only 3 below that, which I wouldn't have imagined him as being in this particular list.
No.
He's higher than Prince. Paul McCartney has 1 note higher vocal range than Prince.
Wow.
Wow.
And this is based on recordings.
That's crazy, though. But yeah, I mean, I can see why Mike Patton would, because he's done difficult vocal styles.
Almost operatic sometimes.
But I think a lot of his highs will be from the inhale screams that you can do. Him and Chino do that a lot, and that allows you to get way, way higher than most people.
So when I was re-listening to Introduce Yourself, and I posted it on Twitter that I was listening, and I was expecting some kind of indie backlash. You know, my followers are largely, you know, into
militant indie fans.
And not a bit of it. I got loads of likes, and one person came out, and he's a massive American Music Club fan, this person that replied. And he said, I mean, he loves both eras. He loves Chucky and Mike Patton eras. And he said, you see, the thing is, Chucky knew he couldn't sing, but he gave great emotion.
Yeah.
And Patton knows he can sing.
Yeah, it's like he knew how to handle what he'd got.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is true.
Because he just sounds like a like a New York thug type person,
with a bit of a cold.
Yeah,
he's got that nasal twang going on.
He's kind of reminiscent to me of Huey from Fun Loving Criminals. Like, he's got a bit of a drawl to him, and it's characterful and great.
I mean, one of my favourite Faith No More songs is Anne's Song.
Yeah.
Which is brilliant.
I mean, it's sort of slightly off-key, talking, singing kind of delivery,
Anne's song is
brilliant.
Yeah.
There's one of the ones you put on the playlist that I thought was a real fun-loving criminals draw.
Are you going to say Evidence?
Yes.
Because that's sort of a smooth funk.
It is. It's kind of lounge jazz metal, I decided. That song. Lounge jazz metal.
The guitar solo is fucking brilliant.
Mm. Did I put Strip Search on there?
It's kind of got like acid jazz in there as well.
But this is the thing with after. So, the two albums with Chuck, then The Real Thing, where the music was written before Mike Patton joined, were fairly straight ahead rap rock.
Yeah.
With a lot of funk elements to it. Then they did Angel Dust, where they started. They released an album called Angel Dust. Then they consumed the drug known as Angel Dust, PCP. They released Angel Dust, where near enough every song has a completely different style.
Yeah.
So you've got funk metal, you've got almost like death metal in some.
There's one in there, you've got
easy listening.
Yeah, because they're covering
Easy's
on that.
Deep crooning on it, and almost kind of like a 60s psych feel on one of the tracks.
Well, Easy wasn't on the original issue.
Ah.
It was put on later on, but that was that era. It's on all the CD reissues of it, I think.
There's a song called Jizz Lobber.
Yeah, and it's fucking
great.
On
that album, though.
Yeah, see, you can't get squeamish if you're listening to Mike Patton.
No, he is a fucking weird lyricist.
He has an album, he has a song, there's a song on King for a Day, Fall for a Lifetime, called Cuckoo for Caca.
Christ.
He is, and there's no nice way to say this.
It's like Gigi Allen or something.
He was obsessed with human shit for a while.
Yes.
To the extent that I remember a Kerrang interview where he was talking about, and this is fucking horrible, whenever they went on tour and he got bored, he would take apart the hairdryer in the hotel room and put some poo inside for the next person.
Which
is just horrible.
I know, you can
you
see.
You are not a good person, Mike Patton.
No. Like, he's done some really grim shit, hasn't he? Definitely.
Grim shit with shit.
Yes.
It's just not right.
No, I really enjoyed one of the quotes about, like, towards the end of Jim Martin's tenure with them, which is, Mike wouldn't look at him when they were on stage together unless he was about to throw something at him.
They're another band a little bit like Dinosaur Jr. who notoriously hated each other.
Yeah.
I
get the feeling it was mostly Mike and Jim.
There was Mike and Jim, but even after Jim Martin left, they were well known for hating each other. Because I wasn't into them when Jim was still in the band. He left pretty much as soon as Angel Dust was released.
Yeah.
He described the album as gay disco music, which, considering Roddy Bottom was in the band, using a homophobic insult probably isn't the best way to go about things.
No.
But he was a bit of a sort of redneck,
metal guitarist kind
of guy. What
he did not fit in with the rest of the band at all.
Not at all. But none of them did. They're all completely disparate personalities.
Yeah.
Which you can tell from their solo projects that they've and side projects that they've done over the years. I mean, Roddy's got Imperial Teen. They're a sort of power pop. Pop rock kind of band.
All right.
You might well like, actually, Tracy.
I might.
You should probably give them a listen. Then you've got Bill Gould was in, although he won't admit this, was in Brugeria.
Yes.
Brugeria, the alleged Mexican
drug dealer.
They're supposedly all members of Mexican cartels.
Yeah.
But that was a band originally formed by Bill Gould, Jello Biafra,
Dino
Cazares from Fear Factory.
Shane Embury from Napalm Death.
He was later on.
Yes.
He wasn't in the original lineup, but he's been, I think, the one constant member since then. And it was Jello Biafra, Bill Gordon, Dino Cazares were all
not
at a party.
Not particularly serious at all.
It's not in any way.
I have their cover version of Macarena, which is called Marijuana.
Yeah. And there was a track called La Migra.
Yes.
Which was about the
Immigration.
It was about smuggling illegal Mexican immigrants across the American border. Which there was a video on one of the old Roadrunner records.
The chorus being "La Migra, La Migra, they'll fuck you in the ass."
Yes.
Yeah, it was very childish,
but actually really, really good. It's basically Mexican death metal with not many of the band members being Mexican.
Yeah, like
that originally they definitely had Hispanic members because Dino Cazares.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if any of the current lineup, because they all have pseudonyms and they all wear like scarves across their face on stage, so you don't really know who it is. Although Shane Embry from Napalm Death,
he's one of the most recognisable human beings.
He's a very, very, very big guy with really big frizzy hair that's receding back to halfway back.
Yeah, he looks like Buzz Osborne's unhealthy brother.
He looks exactly the same as he looked 20 years ago when we used to see him in XLs in Birmingham.
Just look a bit bald.
Yeah. He was fairly bald in then, to be honest.
He was.
So coming back to the side projects, so you put a couple of them on the playlist.
Ian chose those, I believe.
Oh, yeah. Right. So the Dillinger Escape Plan.
That was only one EP.
A guest EP.
Right.
And
I mean...
brilliant.
I don't know, but demented and deranged, I thought.
Well, Dillinger always sound like that, but...
It was just kind of like freeform metal.
Yeah.
Followed by, like, really unsettling prog.
Yeah.
Yep. It's a really uncomfortable album.
And there's a really good cover of Come to Daddy by FX Twin.
When a cover version of Come to Daddy by FX Twin is the most listenable thing ever. Like, it's a fucking harsh album. It's great. I love it. But, it's really difficult.
When Good Dogs Do Bad Things.
Yeah.
Was that the track we put on there?
It was, and I didn't manage the whole 6 minutes of it.
It's a long one, yeah. I should have put Hollywood Squares on
it. I managed about 4 minutes before skipping. But then the one that came after it was Mr. Bungle.
I didn't put the Bungle track on.
No, I put the Mr. Bungle track. I think we should, just before we finish with Dillinger Escape Plan, I think we need to mention what our friend Scott used to call them. Do you remember when Scott was really drunk once?
And Dingalinger Escape Plan,
which is what I have called them ever since.
Yes.
So, yeah, Mr. Bungle was Mike Patton's band before Faith No More.
All right, well, this is my
John
What
Hudson,
the Fuck
the
part
guitarist,
too.
Also in there.
Trey Anastasio, is it?
From Fish.
No, Trey Thingy.
Yeah, not Trey Azagthoth from Morbid Angel.
No, Spruance. But either way, Trey Spruance.
There we go.
Yeah, he was Mr. Bungle's guitarist and later joined Faith No More.
That's right.
For the... was it King
Album
for
Day? Of the Year, I thought.
No, it was King for a Day, Fool for a Lifetime, but decided he didn't want to tour with them, so he only recorded that album.
And then it was John Hudson.
And in the credits to the album, they've got the band members at the top.
Yeah.
Then they've got all the other things like engineers and then all the thanks list. And then right at the end in really small writing, it's got guitar, Trey Spruance.
Wow.
Which is I don't think they were very happy with him at the time.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, Mr. Bungle.
So that, I mean, this was sort of early 90s, wasn't it? I mean,
particular one was. They're still ongoing.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Well, I mean, I don't know. Was there a market for that kind of bizarre hardcore in 91?
Yep.
It wasn't my 1991, I can tell you that.
Weird funk, metal, jazz. It was kind of Zappa influenced.
Yeah, it's pretty weird. It was a really small audience, but there was an audience.
Probably about 8 or 9 years ago now, with my previous girlfriend before my wife, once informed me that Mr. Bungle's debut album is not good Sunday morning hangover music.
It
apparently hurts people's brains.
I would agree with that. Did we put Tomahawk on there?
We didn't, no.
No.
I don't know any Tomahawk. I can't remember who was in
Tomahawk with him. I think it was like someone from the Melvins. And
yes, I think it might well be.
That's a lot more accessible.
Okay.
And sensible.
You put some Dead Cross on
Dead
there.
Dead Cross.
And of all of Patton's other projects, that's the one I like the
most.
That's
his new project.
Very direct. Him and Dave Lombardo.
It's just kind of straight hardcore metal, really.
It goes a bit left field, but not as much. Like, considering the other stuff he's done with Dave Lombardo, Phantomass. It is really sensible and straightforward.
Yeah, Phantomass is... I've only heard the director's cut, which is an album where they're basically doing loads of horror movie themes.
Yeah.
Things like Rosemary's Baby and Psycho.
I think Buzz Osborne's in Phantomass as well, isn't
it? They've had lots of different people in over the years.
Yeah, but it's mostly Lombardo and Patton.
Yeah. With Mr. Bungle, going back to the feud with Anthony Kiedis and the Red Hot Chili Peppers, they did a show. It was Halloween in the mid 90s.
Yeah.
No, it must have been late 90s, where they dressed up as the Red Hot Chili Peppers. So they had long wigs, no shirts. They just came out on stage and did a.
They didn't do this sock thing.
No, I don't. Oh, actually, some of the band members may well have
done. Did they?
But they. There's videos of it on YouTube where they did. They introduced themselves as the Red Hot Chili Peppers and played Red Hot Chili Peppers songs, but in between they were all miming, injecting heroin into their arms and stuff like that.
Shit.
And making really, really disparaging comments.
I bet that went down well.
Mike Patton's not. Like, he's an edgy motherfucker.
He is. And I,
like, did you hear about the INXS thing?
No, I don't think so.
He got asked to audition for INXS.
Okay.
And he said he would only do it if he could do it with a tie around his neck.
Oh, fucking hell!
Like, he's...
Ow!
Yeah. He says... Like, he doesn't fuck around. He says what he thinks.
He's basically
a
cunt, isn't he?
He is basically a cunt, yes. I mean, like, I also watched an interview with him where Wolfmother was soundchecking in the background and
yes.
he's like, stop, wait, what the fuck is this shit? And just really has a massive rant about Wolfmother at one point. Like, yeah, I kind of like the fact that he will say things and does have opinions, but fuck, he's a cunt.
Yeah.
Like, humongously talented, but Jesus.
I think when I was about 15 and reading all this stuff in Kerrang, I used to think,
yeah.
And now, when you grow up, you're just like, don't treat people like that,
yeah,
you bellend.
What are you doing, dude?
Your music's great. He's also, outside of music, though, he's also had a couple of other... things. He was the zombies in Left 4 Dead computer games, and he was also the monstery vampire-y thingies in I Am Legend, the Will Smith movie.
All of them?
The voices for all of them,
shit.
Yeah.
Shit. Well, I mean, with that kind of vocal range and ability to do different...
He also, Bjork did an album called Medulla, where there were no instruments. It was all vocal, so it was all beatboxing and the vast majority of it was Mike Patton and Dokaka, who is a Japanese beatboxer mouth sound.
I believe
type.
They've done an album together
as
well.
They have. So I think you played me years ago,
was
Dokaka's
it?
Versions of like The Trooper by Iron Maiden.
Yes,
stuff like
I think
that.
I probably did. I can't remember it now. I spent a while getting into, like, what is Mike Patton doing this week?
Yeah.
Because it is very much a this week.
Yeah.
He's quite a prolific guy, isn't he? He's also, I think he's put out some like classical Italian opera-y type albums as well, but I've not heard him.
He's got the range,
because
I hate opera. Also, he had a moustache better than Anthony Kiedis.
That's not hard.
Like,
Anthony Kiedis' moustache was fucking terrible.
Well, he's still got it.
As bad as Father John Misty's eyebrows.
Well, they're just non-existent, aren't
they? If Anthony Kiedis stood outside a school with that moustache, he'd get arrested.
I think if Anthony Kiedis stood outside a school, he'd get arrested.
Yeah, pretty much. But
particularly as he'd probably have no shirt on and potentially a sock on his penis.
Whereas if Mike Patton did it, he'd also get arrested, but he'd get arrested because they'd think he was a dealer. So.
Yeah.
Because he does look like a sleazy...
Sleazy is the fucking right word for him, definitely.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people that are fans that, like Ian was saying earlier before we were recording... There's so many people that are like, oh, we'd totally marry Mike Patton, male and female.
Yeah, like...
I don't quite get that.
No.
He's a very
sleazy, greasy...
Yeah, like...
Skeevy-looking dude. Skeevy is the right word.
I've never really wanted to ask.
So, Emma, if you're listening to this, let us know.
Yes, please please tell us why.
I think the main thing that got me into Faith No More... obviously, I'd heard Epic... And from out of nowhere at rock clubs and stuff. But I remember buying, there was a HMV sale where they were selling off a load of music videos.
Yeah.
And I got the Greatest Hits videos collection.
Oh, cool.
On VHS for a quid.
Yeah.
And it was about the same time that I got a Tori Amos one. And in fact, I think I may have bought them on the same day and it got me into both of them. But the Faith No More one. Have you ever seen the video for Everything's Ruined?
No.
Yeah. It's probably my favourite music video of all time.
Yeah.
It's really, really low budget, and it's just them in front of a green screen with various different things happening behind them. So there's right. things like, and every now and again there's like two young girls that are probably about maybe 11 or 12 miming along to it that are the most 90s dressed girls ever, because the album came out in like 92, 93.
Yeah.
And yeah, you can tell by looking at them that it is exactly that time. And there's, of the two girls, one of them sort of a little bit lackluster, sort of slightly dancing, and her friend is really, really getting into it. And then there's another kid of about like probably 15, 16 with his long curtain hair, like jumping about like Zach De La Rocha, rapping along to it. And then you've got the band, and the stuff like the background will suddenly be some footage from like fish swimming under the sea, and they're all pretending to swim.
They didn't take themselves too seriously.
No, they did not take themselves seriously at all.
But which is weird, because I always get the vibe that Mike Patton now takes himself very seriously.
Yeah. But there was an interview from around about that sort of time that I've seen where he's sitting in a studio, and while they're interviewing him, he's eating a massive sandwich and just talking with his mouth full and taking bites out of the sandwich throughout the interview.
I see. The first Faith No More thing I got a taped copy of the live album that they did.
Okay.
Which was basically the entire real thing.
Just live, recorded live.
Recorded live, and with We Care A Lot, and their cover version of War Pigs, which is killer.
War Pigs is on the real thing.
Ah, but it's live version.
The live version's better. I've always thought it's a really pointless cover, though.
But the lyric change, though. Mike Patton, generals gathered in their masses, just like me, they hate Black Sabbath.
That's only on the live one.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
The live version's better because Mike Patton's just doing Mike Patton things.
Yeah. See, on the real thing, it's a really pointless cover because it's so close.
It's basically exactly the same, just with
Mike Patton singing.
Mike Patton, yeah.
Who obviously has a technically better voice than Ozzy.
Yes.
But I'd rather hear Ozzy sing it.
I think the one I love most on that album is Falling to Pieces.
Yeah. With the really cool piano riff.
Yeah. It's just classic Faith No More, isn't it? It's like you're saying about the keyboards really high in the mix. That's just pure Faith No More keyboards throughout that song.
You know, I am actually one step removed from Faith No More on Facebook.
Really?
I am Facebook friends with Robin Guy, who played drums on Top of the Pops when they did Dig in the Grave, because Mike Bordin couldn't be there.
Did you watch the video that I sent you of Robin Guy?
It was ages ago that I watched it, but yeah.
Okay, so Robin Guy was the drummer in Rachel Stamp.
And basically, he's playing in Sham 69.
He does a lot of session work.
Seems like a fucking great guy. Actually.
But so when Faith No More were due to appear on Top of the Pops doing Dig in the Grave, because that was inexplicably a hit, which is great because it's a really heavy, awesome song.
Yeah.
And Mike Bordin's wife was just about to give birth, so he obviously couldn't come over to the UK with them.
Yeah.
So. There's this video, and warning, it contains Davina McCall, but it's actually worth watching because it's really funny. Some TV programme with Davina McCall presenting with Robin Guy, I think it was like some kind of rock stories programme.
Right.
So Robin Guy is telling this story about how he got this phone call, asked to perform with Faith No More on Top of the Pops, and he was like, yes, because you fucking would.
Yeah. I'd learn to play drums to do that.
Yeah, so they brought him in to rehearse with them, and they said, you can only do it with us if you wear this paper mask of Mike Bordin's face. And he was like, it's a bit hard to play drums like that, but okay. And he was a bit gutted because he was going to be on Top of the Pops and nobody would see his face.
Yeah.
So he started playing, and it was just a paper cut-out mask with a bit of string tied around it.
Yeah.
And as soon as he started playing, the paper ripped and it fell off. And he was trying to hold it back on while playing, and it eventually just dropped because he wouldn't be able to carry on playing drums with it. And Mike Patton turned round, thought he'd taken it off on purpose.
Yeah.
And stuck his finger up at him and looked really angry. And on this interview, they show the footage and slow it down. You see him do it.
Oh,
but yeah. So they didn't like him either.
That's sad.
I see.
I like Robin. Robin's a good guy.
He is. He's all of Rachel Stamp are lovely people.
He was the guy that I'd see at gigs.
Yes.
With the girl I was going out with at the time, and she was in love with him. And every time he'd walk past, she'd be like, oh my God. And he'd be like, hey there, how's it going, huh? To me.
Yeah.
And she's like, why the fuck is Robin Guy talking to you? I'm like, I don't know, he just assumes he knows me.
Well, no, Rachel Stamp used to make the effort to talk to the blokes that had obviously been dragged there by their girlfriends at gigs. Which is a really cool thing to do. Papa Roach do it as well.
But like, he's always done that. I've seen him at like two or three other gigs and he's just wandered past me like, oh, hey, dude.
Yeah.
Like, but mostly just like I've been with a bunch of people and they've been like, wait, did... What? Do you know him? I'm like, no, man. He just says hello to me like every time he sees me. It's pretty cool. I like it, but it's fucking weird. But yeah, like, I don't know. I feel sorry for him for having Mike Patton swear at him.
Yeah.
But then again,
it's a pretty fucking cool story.
It probably made him feel like part of the band at that point.
Yeah, because they all hated each other. So it's like, right, you're one of us now. Fuck you. But and he did get to be on Top of the Pops with people seeing his face playing with Faith No More, so that's fine.
Yeah. So bragging rights for a while, isn't it?
Definitely. I think we're about done there.
Yeah, yeah.
So the next episode is the G episode. So we will be talking about...
I can't even remember.
Not Guns N' Roses.
No, because we did that last year.
Gravity Kills.
That'd be good.
Gojira.
Good band. No.
Why aren't Gojira on the list?
I don't think they are.
I want them to be on the list.
Well, perhaps for series 4, because we've got the next two series planned out.
Damn it.
Gregor Samsa, which was one of your choices.
Yes, I was going to say, can we trade out Gojira for... No, we're leaving Gregor Samsa. I love them.
And Green Day. I like Green Day, sure.
I like old Green Day.
Well, we can talk mainly about old Green Day then.
That's good. Let's do that.
Yeah. We've been We Dig Music. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye.